Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Elizabeth Olsen and Carrie Coon chat to me about the powerful new movie, His Three Daughters, about three sisters living in a crowded apartment looking after their dying father. I also talk to its director, Azazel Jacobs, WandaVision showrunner and now creator of the new Disney series Agatha All Along, chats to me about defying Marvel convention. And I talk to Ashley Park about playing Lily Collins' best friend in Emily in Paris. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well and you've got a chance to enjoy some of this delightful weather. By golly. I think, you know, sometimes you can be accused of talking from the East Coast or a sunny part of Ireland, but I think it's been nationwide, as far as I can tell, from what I've seen. Glorious, glorious weather. Maybe you're at the ploughing. Maybe that went well for you. I have to say, as a longtime radio producer and researcher at the ploughing, it's not an event I look forward to. I've had too many white knuckle rides in terms of guests not showing up. Rain blocking guests' arrival, rain blocking radio presenters' arrival, and muck and filth. To the point, I remember once years ago, musician Luca Bloom nearly missed his slot on a radio show for us when he had the foresight to borrow someone's bike and cycled all through the ploughing. So it's not an event I remember fondly, but I know I'm in very much the minority because a lot of people do and particularly enjoyed it this year, which seemed to have been the sunniest one on record. So hats off to you if you were there, but I certainly wasn't. A lot of people enjoyed Ian McKellen last week on the show. A lot of people enjoyed Lily Collins, and the views on social media for that video of her talking were into the millions, 1.3 million, which is kind of mind-boggling to me as someone who barely knows what TikTok is. But there you go. I suppose the big news in movies and TV, particularly this week, was the Emmys. And Shogun on Disney Plus really did remarkably well. Now, here's the truth. I haven't watched Shogun. I just never got around to it. There's so much stuff to watch. But it seems like I'm going to have to, and lots of people have recommended it. I was delighted to see Hacks One. We've spoken many times on the show about that brilliant series that pairs a young writer and an aging comedian together in Las Vegas. It's a hilarious show that you should check out if you haven't. Baby Reindeer also did well, which was great to see. And I wish Andrew Scott could win something for Ripley, though, because I just thought he was brilliant. I don't think Andrew Scott has won enough awards. Now, Richard Gadd did win in his category for Baby Reindeer, which I can't really complain about, but I would love Andrew Scott to win something, either for Ripley or the movie last year, All of Us Strangers. The ship has probably passed now, or sailed. That's what ships do. They sail. They don't pass necessarily. They sail, to use the correct verb. But he's probably not going to win one at this stage. But I think it's a shame because he was brilliant in Ripley. Now, one other thing that I noticed in the Emmys was Slow Horses, a show on Apple TV that's now in its fourth season. The fourth season only started recently, that I only have just gotten to, and this week alone finished the first season. Now, the names of them change, but it's the Slow Horses series on Apple TV, where you have Gary Oldman being the most world-weary MI5 boss you've ever seen in your life. And he's over a group of misfits, people who've been sent to him who've had problems in MI5, and they're sent to this place, Slough House, and they're called Slow Horses. And they're tasked with very dull kind of, you know, office jobs as opposed to proper MI5 activities. But they all slowly get involved. I've just watched the first season of it. Absolutely brilliant. So gritty, grimy, real. I was going to say a page turner, which is the completely wrong analogy. You just want to watch the next one. They are based on a series of books, but Slow Horse is based on one season so far. absolutely phenomenal. And I can't wait to get into to the next three when time allows, because it's absolutely brilliant. And Gary Oldman, he's done a lot of great things, but by golly, is he good in Slow Horses. So do let me know if you might have watched Slow Horses, how you feel about Ripley, how you feel about Shogun, how you feel about The Bear on Disney Plus Season 3, which won a lot of awards at the Emmys this week. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now, this week, I was also watching this.
Yo, it's my bitch-ass sister. She's trying to tell me the smoke is killing our dad.
How is Vinny?
Well, he's dying, but not because of my weed smoke.
I understand what a stressful situation it is. It's very nice that you're all here at a time like this. We all want your father to transition as peaceful as possible.
It's nice that it's us. This is the way it should be, the way he would want it.
The plan is we all will take turns watching over. You know she hasn't done a shift, right?
Oh, yeah.
You don't find that strange? Once we get here, she steps back from all responsibility.
Your life is perfect. You got your kid. Probably gonna pop out a bunch more.
No, nothing pops. There's no popping. That's not the way it is.
Okay, whatever. It looks like popping to me.
Katie started drinking a few hours ago.
How do you like the food?
Thank you for the dinner.
Watch her not even wash her dishes.
Now that is a clip from the poignant new movie, His Three Daughters. It focuses on three siblings who gather at the family home of their father, who's terminally ill. Though the women have vowed to support each other and put their father through care first, there are severe family differences and issues that we become aware of throughout the course of the film. And it's a complicated family, as most of them are. Now, Rolling Stone have called this the movie of the year, and it got a cinema release on the 6th of September, and it's going to be on Netflix from this Friday, the 20th of September. And we have, playing the three sisters, Elizabeth Olsen, who's the kind of free-spirited Christina, and she's playing, I suppose, the referee or the peacemaker between the bossy, talkative Katie, played by Carrie Coon, and I suppose the sometimes very funny sports betting, very fond of the weed, Rachel, played by Natasha Lyonne, who a lot of people will know from the also talkative convict in Orange is the New Black. The movie, it's a powerful watch, and it's quite serious, but it's also quite funny. It was directed by a man called Azazel Jacobs. It was shot rather unusually in that it's filmed in sequence over 3 days in this pretty small Manhattan apartment. As I mentioned, it stars Elizabeth Olsen, who, you know, is related, is the sister of the Olsen twins. That has very little to do with who she is now. She's been acting for a long time now, is in a great thriller, Wind River, Ingrid Goes West. Of course, to many people, remembered as the Scarlet Witch, Wanda Maximoff, and she would come into bloom in her own in that pretty great series, WandaVision, on Disney, which kind of refigured a lot of superhero TV shows, it has to be said. Opposite her, I mentioned, is Carrie Coon, playing the kind of bossy sister, Katie, in this. Carrie Coon has been in The Leftovers, Ghostbusters Afterlife, The Gilded Age. She herself was in Avengers Infinity War in Proxima Midnight. I got to talk to Carrie Coon and also Elizabeth Olsen about His Three Daughters. Elizabeth, what's fascinating about it is I think I know exactly who the three characters are within 5 minutes of them arriving on screen. And then it's like, where are these people going? And it's slowly real. For instance, you're big into The Grateful Dead, and then you're ringing home to your daughter, and I'm wondering what's going on with her husband. There's something I'm not quite getting, and I mean that as a compliment. Like, it must be kind of a gift as an actor to get a part like this and see the journey it takes.
I think the greatest gift with the journey was being able to shoot in order, and there's so much you can do before starting a job and trying to figure out these, if you know the schedule a little bit ahead of time, these pillars that you hold on to, knowing that, okay, we're at, you know, day two, we are going to jump all the way to 2/3 into the film. And so I have to kind of figure out what the structure means and where I would be then. And luckily there was none of that jumping around for the most part. We really got to shoot in order. So there was as much prep work as you can about your relationships with the people that you are speaking to off camera. You have to obviously make decisions and choices about that, or I guess not so obviously. You can also just, you know, fake it till you make it, which is also, you know, totally valid as long as it's believable to the audience. It doesn't really matter which way you do it. But there is a gift in being able to shoot it in order that we all surprised, I think, ourselves in where we ended up because we were allowed to live through the experiences of the character and learn from it and not be committed to something we chose out of kind of nothing.
Yeah. And Carrie, I gather, you know, and Elizabeth's alluded to it there, that this was probably like working on no other movie you'd worked on before in terms of the way he shot, being in this apartment. Like it must be you, and you've done lots of things and you've done big machine things and small machine things, but this seemed kind of unique.
Definitely. I mean, that was part of the allure of it. Not only was it written for us and then we actually were able to do it together. Mm. But Aza knew exactly what his budget was. He knew what the shots were. The way that the film is filmed is actually written into the screenplay. So there's nothing arbitrary. And when you're working on TV or some of these big machines that have gobs of money, they can afford to make mistakes, then you don't have to be so prepared and so specific. And we also telling the story in order is such a lost art. The only place we do that is the theater. So for me, it did feel like a similar to preparing for theater, which is something I return to regularly when I can. But it was very pleasurable. And the thing you identified in your first question is also true. It's structured so that you meet us as stereotypes and as how we see each other. And then as our point of view of each other gets complicated in the film, so does the audience's point of view of us get complicated. And that structure is very baked in and it's very deft and very specific. And I love that craftsmanship.
Yeah. And either of you can answer this. I gather, though, he gave you like movies to watch to get you to like inhabit a kind of 90s indie New York cinema Paul Auster kind of vibe. So he gave you a homework, the cheek.
There was no real assignment, but you and Aza did that.
Oz and I just kind of hung out as friends and we watched some clips from films that I hadn't seen. And then he talked, and it wasn't necessarily direct references of a style or a tone. It was more about what lives in his deepest lizard brain in a way, consciously or unconsciously while he's writing. And so I think I think every time I work with a filmmaker, I try as much as I can, even if it's not directly related to the film itself, to understand their point of view so that I can access a part of their imagination as best as I can. Mm-hmm. And so I did watch some films because of that. And there are Hal Hartley films, there are Romare films. There was an Interiors, which is a Woody Allen film that's kind of lost, and his love song to Bergman. And so there are pieces like that I watch just to kind of understand more about where Oz is coming from as a filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah. And just talking of doing something outside the box, I'm just kind of out of time, but I loved you in WandaVision for a similar reason, in that this was superhero stuff, but it was told in such a unique, trippy, weird kind of way. Do you look back on that show with a tremendous amount of fondness? Because it was kind of a game changer for superhero serials.
Yeah, I think we were all shocked by the response of it because it was, we really felt like we were doing one of the strangest things Marvel had tried to do. And we felt like, well, we're either going to, you know, we're probably going to fail, but that's okay because this is really crazy and fun that we're taking a big stab at or a big swing at something that they hadn't shown before. But I think also with that show, speaking to this idea of the very specific form that Oz was sticking to with telling the story, WandaVision in its own way had a very specific structure and form, and it was these Marvel larger than life characters, but they were. This story had to be told through television. And I think it was strange to imagine these characters not on TV, but the structure of the storytelling could only have been told in television. Yeah. And so they made it make sense for the medium. And I think that was incredibly important and specific to that project.
Yeah. Well, look, you're getting to work with great people, it seems. So continued success to both of you. Thanks
Thank
a lot.
You so much.
Elizabeth Olsen there talking about WandaVision and also his three daughters, which is now on Netflix from the 20th of September. And you also heard Carrie Coon there talking to me about the great new movie on Netflix that was directed by Asasel Jacobs, who gave us a movie a couple of years ago called The Lovers, which was very successful, all about a couple who've been having extramarital affairs but managed to fall back in love, starring Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts and our own Aidan Gillen, which is now being remade because it was so successful. So I spoke to Asasal Jacobs about his three daughters and the unusual process of making it. I was surprised when I was reading up about it. I kind of naturally assumed you front and center were thinking of your own parents or you were caring for someone, but I gather that wasn't necessarily the motivation. Like, this wasn't a personal story you were mining from your own life. So what was the motivation for you?
I would say it was me mining from my own life in terms of just something that seemed like my parents are elderly, and there's something that seemed very far away in terms of their passing suddenly became very close. And I was becoming a caretaker for them. And I was learning how to do that and just trying to understand, how do you take care of your parents in this way? How do you change this relationship? How do I figure out their doctors, and how do I figure out how to medication? All these things suddenly felt very out of control and confusing to me. And then it lent itself to me telling a story which I felt like I had a window of time before I was going to fully become a caretaker. So yes, I've definitely, some of it comes from experiences that I've had in the past of loved ones passing. But a lot of this came from me in preparation for what was suddenly very tangible in front of me. Mm-hmm. And trying to deal with some of those fears before it happened, which may be silly, and also trying to deal with some of the hopes that I have as well in terms of making it through, because it's hard for me to imagine the person they'll be when they're both gone.
And I guess it's a universal fear of anyone who's alive in lots of ways. I was talking to Elizabeth and Carrie just a few minutes ago, and the thing that or certainly Elizabeth was most pleased about, it seemed to me, when she was talking to me, was shooting in order. It seemed like such a gift for them. And I gather that's a very hard thing to do. And the bigger a movie, the impossibility that slowly becomes. From the get-go, did you want it to be shot in sequence?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I love about the smaller things. That's what I love about punk rock. I felt like that always, that's what it said, which was like, hey, actually what you have right in front of you can be an advantage that other thing, bigger productions or bigger whatever, more money would entail. Like, that they lose that ability. So this was something that was one of the attributes I could sell to not only to myself but to the actors, of saying, hey, yeah, we may not do it this way, but we're going to do it this way, which will afford something that they can never do. And shooting in order is one of those luxuries. It means that you're always talking about a scene that you've already done before, that you know where you're coming from, that you're building on top of it. And it's not like a make-believe, well, you know, when we shoot that in 2 weeks, hopefully you're going to be coming from this emotional place. But we could actually say, well, yesterday, this is what happened, and this is where you were when we called rap, and this is where we're picking up from. So it was something very concrete.
Yeah. And can I ask you just like a boring, mundane question, but just on that, like, it takes place over 3 emotionally filled days. How long did it take to shoot? I presume longer than 3 days.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're definitely being painstaking in terms of, we're shooting on film. And so it you still are moving at a certain speed, even though it was very fast. I think we shot truly over about 17 days. So what that meant was, extensive, especially with the cinematographer Sam Levy and I, like, talking quite a lot about how we're going to cover this, knowing exactly what we're looking for, and that by the time we were rolling on each scene, that we had prepared ourselves, whether just going through blocking or rehearsal, whatever it was, so that we were going to be able to pull off this type of schedule. But it also meant that we were shooting, for the most part, every scene completely. So we were never leaving half of a scene done and coming back to it the next day, because we really did have to stay on a clip. I have to say, it was tight, but again, it was like one of these advantages that I felt like I guess, you know, I know that every film has less days than they used to many years ago. But in this case, I wouldn't have wanted more time. I don't know what I would have done with that. There was a certain pressure that was really helpful for this film.
I sat down to watch this last night. I really enjoyed it. And my wife watched it with me as well. And I was telling her what it was about beforehand. And she was going, are we going to do this on a Sunday night? I have to go to work tomorrow. Yeah. And just bear with me for a second. So I suppose, you know, how do you get people in who might think, do I want to watch a movie about three daughters attending to the possible death of their father? Maybe, but that's not your question to answer. But I'm just saying that was my wife's reaction. Now, she loved it once she watched it. But do you ever think about, you know, this is a bleak piece of storytelling I'm engaging here. How do I find an audience for it who may not be up for that?
You know what it is that I really needed this story going through this. I don't have that many examples. There's a few films that I could see of families dealing with it in this way that I felt like, oh, I could relate to. So I believe, you know, like this is the best case scenario, right? That you outlive your parents. But I still felt completely confused and without a roadmap and some sense of anything. So my hope is that people are going to need this film as much as I did. And just in terms of just going like, okay, I can relate to this. I can experience it. And the other thing is that like I cast these actors not only for their great ability, but also that they all have really good comedy chops. And like, I wanted that. Like the truth is that making this film was very joyful. And I hope that that gets ultimately communicated to an audience that this is not a heavy, I have no interest in making something that's just going to weigh you down. I want this to be fun and funny and joyful besides all the other things.
And it is absolutely. And I was playing devil's advocate there. You realize, tell me this, your previous two movies ago, but The Lovers, very successful, had a fellow countryman of mine, Aidan Gillen, in it, which is always nice to see. I gather that's been made into a kind of different version in India.
Can you believe that?
That must be deeply satisfying.
Amazing, amazing. You sit down in a little coffee shop, you write a script, and the film comes out. I'm proud of it. It exists. I'm happy that it's found a life, that people have responded in the way that they have. And then I get this email that there's like, you know, they want to retell this story and very culturally specific. Like they're not just trying to just translate it, but they actually like bring it over into their world. And I got to see it. A lot of the framing is the same framing as the film that I made. Except it's very somebody else's personal story. It is the dream situation. I wonder if like bands feel that way when they hear covers, or they like. For me, this was just like I just go. It's yours. Run with it. That's all. Like, I just wanted them to find their own way with it. And watching the film has been a total joy. But completely surprising. One of those amazing experiences that, like, I don't know. I hope that I heard there's other countries now that are interested in telling the story. It's a really simple story. I think that's a thing.
I know.
You know, like, The Lovers is, you know, what happens if, you know, really if a couple who have been cheating on each other fall in love with each other. It's like very, very basic. So I think there's something about this, the simplicity of that story that could translate to other countries and other cultures the way it has so far.
Yeah, we'll await it. But in the meantime, His Three Daughters is great. So I hope that goes far and wide for you. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you for the time.
Asasal Jacobs there talking to me about, well, The Lovers, his movie from a few years ago, but ostensibly about His Three Daughters, which is on Netflix from the 20th of September this Friday. And a great watch it is too. And I think there will be Oscar buzz about it. Now, we talked about WandaVision there. The person who created that was a lady called Jack Schaefer, and she's talking to me after the break about her new Disney superhero, well, Marvel, witchy, fantasy series, Agatha All Along. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and movie show. I'm John Fardy. Now, take a listen to this.
That witch is gone. leaving you trapped in her distorted spell. Claw your way out. She took every bit of power I had, but I can beat that witch again.
Well, the gang's all here. Let's hit the road.
I'm gonna walk the witch's road. The road is a death wish. Join me.
Yes, now that is a clip from the new Disney series, which is now streaming, called Agatha All Along. It's the new series from the creator of WandaVision, Jack Schaefer, and it picks up after the final events of WandaVision, where WandaVision's neighbor, played by Catherine Hahn, Agatha, or Agnes, as she was called in that, is drained of all her powers. Agatha, who was a witch from Salem named Agatha Harkson, bent on acquiring Wanda's powers for herself. That was how WandaVision ended. WandaVision was a very inventive Marvel series from a few years ago, and starring the aforementioned Elizabeth Olsen, that kind of did a superhero thing but used sitcoms as kind of the modus operandi. It was a very clever show. So what we have in Agatha All Along the Way is the return of Agatha, played by Catherine Hahn, as I said, and she's now a detective. Or at least that's the way it seems. But then it flips. And like it did in WandaVision, the walls of reality start to fall down. And Audrey Plassey shows up and attempts to destroy her. So Agatha is going to put a new coven of witches together and find and walk along the Witch's Road, which apparently, according to lore, if anyone finds it, will restore her heart's desire. So she cobbles together this coven of witches and takes off on this kind of road movie journey all along the Witch's Road with this newly assembled coven of witches. Now, if you don't know anything about Marvel or WandaVision or who Agatha is, it doesn't really matter. This, like WandaVision, is very inventive and entertaining. And I don't really think, even though it's from Marvel, is a superhero show. It's witches and fantasies. There are superhero elements to it, but it's entertaining, inventive TV in the way that WandaVision was. Catherine Hahn is great in it. It was created, the showrunner, that is, by Jack Schaefer, who I mentioned, who also created WandaVision. So she has a talent for this. Her first movie actually was a movie called Timer, which was all about people counting down. They had this device which counted down the day till they found their soulmate. Very inventive mind, I have to say. So I spoke to Jack Schaefer about Agatha All Along and a bit more besides. I had this. This is a true story. So I was watching this over the weekend, and about 10 minutes in, I stopped and checked my email because I thought I was watching the wrong show. Because what I was watching seemed to be something almost like The Mayor of Easttown, this procedural, gritty, you know, down-at-heel drama. Is that kind of your intention, though, in a way, that you're, you know, turning upside down what people might think of Marvel and maybe even witches and fantasy?
John, that is just such a compliment. You have no idea how much that delights me.
It's the truth.
Oh, my goodness. I am absolutely after the opportunity to surprise any audience member. I believe in entertainment first. I believe in delighting an audience. But that sort of moment where you either you lean forward or you gasp or you hold your breath or you're like, wait a minute. And the fact that you like stopped and it sort of infected your life, you know, like you had to like step outside and check something is so delightful to me because that's what I want out of entertainment. I want it to bleed into my life. And to make me question everything around me. So that's really tremendous. Yeah, I mean, that is what I want to do. I'm such a fan of movies and TV. And so I've fallen into this space in the MCU where I'm allowed to pay tribute to, you know, other artists and do it in like a 360 way, in a holistic way, but then build, you know, we build our own story within that. And I find it, you know, really kind of rapturous.
Yeah. The Witch's Road thing is fascinating and it looked like it, but I double checked it this morning. There seemed to be no CGI or anything like that. It was all practical effects. What What were you trying to do with that? Or what were you trying to say with that? Was it trying to evoke the Wizard of Oz or something?
Yeah, that was part of the inspiration was, you know, the Wizard of Oz is a big touchstone for us. There are many reasons. One of them is it was an extension of what we did on WandaVision. You know, for the first few episodes of WandaVision, when we were in the, you know, 50s and 60s and 70s, we were so committed to the authenticity of the look and feel of those eras that we use practical effects for the sort of bewitched elements of it.
Yeah.
And that was such a satisfying experience. It lent such a beautiful tone and texture to the episodes themselves. It was so invigorating to the performers. It just was a success across the board. I mean, even down to recording in front of a live studio audience, like, you know, really digging in this way just worked. And so when we approached this show and we knew it was going to be witchy and so many of our touchstones were from the 80s and 90s, it felt correct that we adopt these practices, that we use matte paintings and forced perspective and puppets, miniatures. And so that, you know, gave a quality to the show visually that we love. And then also we were defining witchcraft in the MCU. And as we defined it, it is a practice that is directly connected to the natural world. So it feels right that everything has a texture to it, that it's, you know, it's real fire, it's real water. It just felt necessary.
Yeah, well, it worked. Let me ask you in closing then. Your very first movie, Timer, about someone who's going to meet their soulmate on a specific date and time with the use of this wristband. Does that was like 2009. I'm presuming you wrote it long before that. Does it seem to you maybe that was incredibly prescient when you think about it in the world of dating apps and AI? Has that thought ever struck you that maybe I was ahead of the curve?
That maybe I'm a genius? No, it's never occurred to me.
Until you met me, I've confirmed.
I'm so smart. You know, that's another huge compliment. You know, I love sci-fi, speculative fiction, dystopian things, you know, like it was very much inspired by Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Okay.
And you know, I wrote it in 2007, really when Apple stores were happening. And so it was kind of tied to that sort of smartphone moment. You know, now that it's all these years later, I'm married, you know, and I sort of peek around at what the dating situation is.
You found your soulmate then.
I found my soulmate. No, I'm still looking. I'm on all the apps now. But I'm amazed, but not really surprised at where we are. I keep expecting alarms to go off. I know that in Japan there is technology where if you're in proximity of someone whose profile matches yours, like it will ding. So I'm just like waiting to behold it in life.
Wow, it's a brave new world. Well, we should just all sit at home and watch TV and not venture out.
I'm
and
with
watch
you.
Agatha all along. Lovely to talk to you.
You as well. Thank you so much.
Jack Schaefer there talking to me about her new series, Agatha All Along, which is now on Disney Plus. And she was talking to me there about Timer as well, her first movie. And we had a laugh. Funny talking to Jack. I sound like Al Pacino there. Funny. Oh. Can I get a cappuccino? Hoo-ah! I'm just entertaining myself really at this stage. If I have any listeners left, do stay tuned, because after the break, I'll be talking to Emily in Paris's best friend. Now you're welcome back to the last part of Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now last week I brought you my interview with Lily Collins for the second part of season 4 of Emily in Paris. All about Emily, who's moved to Paris and has an ideal job. Well, not always ideal job. She's working in a marketing agency and the show kind of involves her life in that agency and the various travails she encounters, and of course, the problems, the ups and downs in her somewhat complicated love life. Our interview with Lily Collins got 1.3 million views on TikTok. That is how popular this show is. I'm with all false humility aside, I'm aware that that amount of viewers on TikTok has nothing to do with me, but has to do with the popularity of that show. And as I said to you last week, you know, some people can't stand that show, but people who love it absolutely love it. It's a very Darren Star-esque show, the man who gave us the wonderful Sex and the City. And people complain it's popcorn, but it's very entertaining popcorn for the people who enjoy it. And I am one of those. It's escapism, but it's entertaining escapism. The second part of season four is now on Netflix with Lily Collins continuing seek happiness in both love and work. Now, in the series, her best friend is played by the actress Ashley Park, Mindy Chan, and she's really her greatest supporter and someone she got to know when she moved to Paris. And I suppose two of her best pals in the agency she works in, Samuel Arnold plays Julian, and Bruno Gray plays Luke. If you know the show, you'll know they're the two kind of colleagues of hers who are, I suppose, comic foil in some ways, and very fine, funny actors they are too. So I spoke to Ashley Park, Samuel Arnold, and Bruno Gray about Emily in Paris.
Bonjour.
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 How are you all today?
Good.
Good.
How about you?
I'm not too bad. All the better for talking to you. Ashley, if I can start with you, you know, your character, she is so behind Emily. She's 100% her friend. You know, a lot of times with our friends, even though we love them, sometimes we can't help but be jealous of them or, you know, just want what they want, even though, because we're human. Whereas Mindy is just all about Emily. She adores it from her head to her toes. Is that fair to say? Is that how you see her?
I absolutely do. I think it's very much reflective in me and Lily's friendship in real life. I don't think there's been ever a moment where either of us are... I think that's why we adore this friendship and also playing it on screen so much, is that I think that women are often pitted against each other and often have those kinds of, oh, there must be some kind of jealousy, there must be this. And truly, I think both of us believe in each other, and I think both characters believe in the other more than they even believe in themselves. And so I think that I love that we get to portray a friendship that's very genuine to us on the screen.
Okay. And it's nice to hear that that's the way it is in real life as well. So that's a scoop, I guess.
Yeah.
Samuel, a lot of people probably talk to you about the fashion of things, and the clothes are amazing. And I'm not that fashionable of a person, as you can clearly see. But even I, as a middle-aged man,
I'm
very taken with the clothes, and some of the suits both you and Bruno wear are amazing. Are you yourself... like, were you a fashionable kind of guy? Because I think it takes a certain kind of actor to be able to pull off those clothes, and you clearly do it.
Well, first of all, I want to say that, to me, obviously, it's just my opinion, that being fashionable, it means being comfortable in what you're wearing. And so in that case, you are fashionable, because you seem pretty comfortable.
But Samuel's also extremely fashionable. He's got an awesome sense of style.
And also, like, I've always really liked clothing, because, like, I'm a kid. Like, I'm inspired by anything. I would dress like the cartoons that I would watch on TV, or my favorite singer or rapper, or favorite video games. I would always use clothes to vehiculate whatever inspires me. And having the opportunity to portray a character like Julian just opened up a whole new world. And yeah, I just realized that I can wear whatever I want. I can wear anything now. That's where the show got me.
Bruno, one thing I notice is you're talking to an Irishman, and we have a reputation for drinking a lot, which is a stereotype, and there is some truth in it. But you guys at these lunches have a lot of wine, you know, and I find it very hard to go back to the office if I drank that much wine. Now, I know it's only TV, but is that an accurate kind of Parisian or French thing? I mean, do French people drink plenty at lunchtime?
Well, it happened. You know, there is something strange. When you're in your culture, you consider your culture as normality. Because, you know, so, for example, for Italians, the coffee, normal coffee is like this. For the French, it's like this. For the Americans, it's like this. But everyone say to you, it's normal, you know? So when you are, I'm bicultural, so I can see the French with the Italian eye sometime. So I have to say that the French drinks a lot. The French drinks. And they said, oh, come on, I don't drink. I take a bottle of wine, you know, a beer, and after the aperitif. So it's not too much. For maybe for the Italians, it's bigger, you know?
They drink too, though.
So, yeah, they drink, but I think the Italians drink less than the French.
Yeah.
And there is one country that they drink more than the French, the Irish.
I'm glad to bask in the stereotype. Had a lot of drinks at lunch, though. There are certain scenes you're like, Luke, you're really not. What's happening to you right now? He's like, I had too much at lunch.
Ashley, finally, can I just? I saw you in Mean Girls earlier in the year,
Oh wait, the movie or the musical?
Here's what I'm going to say to you. Not the musical, unfortunately, because I would have had to go to Broadway.
But the fact that
you got to be in the movie, having been in the musical, that must have been a joy when they called you to do that.
Oh, gosh, that was a crazy... I think I was able to go to set for one day. I was flying in the day before and then after. But for me, it's all about the people. It's like if, you know, I love Tina Fey and I love Jeff Richmond and that whole group so much. And I obviously, that was a huge part of my life. So when they were like... Can you come play a cameo part? I said yes. And then they're like, you're going to be the French teacher because we think that's a fun Easter egg. Yeah. And I was like, wait, but why am I can't teach. Why am I teaching French? That's the worst. I have to speak French and Mean Girls.
That was, but I saw it. You killed it, though.
I don't want, we're professionals. We got to get there. But that was so, I think my biggest thing was that it said Madame Park. And I was like, I'm a Madame? My gosh. But
that's the best.
It was so fun to see those people and those creators again. So I was happy to step back into that world. Kind of like how we feel every season, coming back every season. We're like, we're back in these shoes of these people again. It's fun.
Yeah. Well, listen, you're all killing it in Emily in Paris. So continued success to you all. And thanks for talking to me.
Thank you so much.
Ashley Park, Samuel Arnold and Bruno Gore there, who play Mindy Chen, Julian and Luke, opposite Lily Collins in Emily in Paris season 4. All of it is now available to stream on Netflix. That is it for this week. We will do it all again next week. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all next week.